arrogance. What do you think of when you think of that word? There's a few pictures that come to my mind. One that I was thinking about as I was preparing for this message was my Uncle Jim. My mother was one of four girls and one boy. And all the girls were pretty wonderful people and cared about others. And then there was Uncle Jim. Uncle Jim loved to hear himself talk. When he and one of his sisters would come over and visit with us, maybe my mother was visiting at the time or whatever, or maybe it was just our family that he would visit, he would spend the vast majority of the visit being the one talking. And if anyone else started to talk, he would just talk over them, and he was just sure that everything he had to say, we were hanging on every word. I mean, it was so bad that when he and his sister got to their homes after the visit, my aunt would phone us and say, I want to apologize for Jim. I kept saying, he's not your fault. Arrogance. We see it around us, and it's not pretty. It's not pretty. Well, today we're going to be looking at Zephaniah chapter 3. If you don't know where that is, find Matthew chapter 1 and go back four books. Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. We're going to be looking at Zephaniah chapter 3. And in Zephaniah 3, we're going to see some interesting things as God talks through Zephaniah about the sad state of Jerusalem and Judea. The terms are used interchangeably, because Jerusalem is the capital of Judah. And we're going to see God's indictment on Jerusalem. We're going to see his actions towards Jerusalem's enemies as God recounts to Judah why they should be faithful to him. We're going to see God's expectations of Jerusalem. We're going to see what God does about the fact that Jerusalem hasn't done what he wanted them to do. And we're going to see a beautiful picture of what happens after that. So Zephaniah chapter 3. We'll go briefly through some of these. God's indictment on Jerusalem, verses 1 through 4. Woe to her who is rebellious and defiled, the oppressing city. She listens to no voice. She accepts no correction. She does not trust in the Lord. She does not draw near to her God. Her officials within her are roaring lions. Her judges are evening wolves that leave nothing till the morning. Her prophets are fickle, treacherous men. Her priests profane what is holy. They do violence to the law. What a picture of God's chosen people. Rebellious, oppressing, treacherous men. Roaring lions, evening wolves, leaving nothing till the morning. Does this sound like people who are godly people? We talked in our Bible class this morning about the fact that sin comes from arrogance, from self-seeking. John said in 1 John chapter 2, all that is in the world, the lust of the eye, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life is not from the Father, but from the world. And I think we're going to see a pattern as we go through here about the fact that when people live lives of sin, when they allow these lusts to enter into them and don't take effort to push them aside and replace them with more wholesome thinking, bad things are going to happen. Verses 5 through 8. The Lord within her is righteous. He does no injustice. Every morning he shows forth his justice. Each dawn he does not fail, but the unjust knows no shame. I have cut off the nations, their battlements are in ruins. I have laid waste their streets so that no one walks in them. Their cities have been made desolate, without a man, without an inhabitant. So God is saying here, Jerusalem is so corrupt, but I, your God, am not corrupt. In fact, I've laid the smackdown on some of your enemies. I am not unjust. Verses 7 and 8. I said, surely you will fear me. You will accept correction. Then your dwelling would not be cut off according to all that I have appointed against you. But all the more they were eager to make all their deeds corrupt. Therefore, wait for me, declares the Lord, for the day when I rise up to seize the prey. For my decision is to gather nations, to assemble kingdoms, to pour out upon them my indignation, all my burning anger. For in the fire of my jealousy, all the earth shall be consumed. Verse 7 is such a sad verse. After talking to Judah about the fact that he had gone out against their enemies, he comes back to Judah and he says, surely you will fear me. You will accept correction. You know, you kind of hope when you're raising your kids that they'll learn from the mistakes of others, you know, especially if they have older siblings, you know. Didn't you see what happened to your brother when he did something like that? But no, they don't learn from others. They have to make their own mistakes all over again. And Judah was no different. Judah could see God's hand against their enemies and not realize that if they acted contrary to God, if they broke the covenant, the same type of thing would be in store for them. How that must have broken God's heart. God even wanted the surrounding nations to be better than they were. But God had higher expectations for his people. And yet, what does it say? Sorry, where's that? All the more they were eager to make all their deeds corrupt. Didn't matter how much God called to them, didn't matter how high his expectations of them, the more they were supposed to be coming to him, the more they resisted and went the other way. Hosea said it like this, when Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. The more they were called, the more they went away. That was from Hosea 11, verse 2. It's just like that rebellious child that you can't do a thing with. That is exactly who Jerusalem was. God wanted to be able to expect better out of his own chosen people. The ones on whom he had chosen to lavish his affections. After all, theirs were the stories of deliverance from Egyptian slavery. The miraculous care that God took of them for 40 years in the wilderness after the incredible giving of the law on Mount Sinai with earthquakes and fire and thunder. Theirs was the giving of the land, a land that was move-in ready. So many things that should have spoken to them about God's love and his care, his provision, his deliverance. But no, Jerusalem was as bad as her neighboring countries.
Verses 9 and 10. For at that time I will change the speech of the peoples to a pure speech, that all of them may call upon the name of the Lord and serve him in one accord. From beyond the rivers of Cush, my worshipers, the daughter of my dispersed ones, shall bring my offerings. So in the previous verses, God had talked about the fact that the people who were against him, even in Jerusalem, were going to be dealt with severely, that they would be wiped out. So now in these verses, 9 and 10, God says something really interesting. At that time, I will change the speech of the peoples to a pure speech. And then he talks about people gathering from all over the world to be his worshipers. Now, this prophecy might be one that... There are a few prophecies in the Old Testament that are double prophecies. They have an immediate meaning, and they have a longer-term, greater meaning. This might be one of those prophecies, because it might be talking about... Okay, the Jews were taken into captivity in Babylon not too long after this, but they were only there for 70 years. And after that, people would be brought back and allowed to worship God again in their own land. Not everybody came back, but a lot of people did. But I believe that the greater fulfillment of this prophecy about changing the speech of the peoples to a pure speech, about people coming from all over the world, happened on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2. In Acts chapter 2, we see Jews, again, because not everybody came back after Babylon. Some Jews were scattered and stayed scattered over the whole world, building synagogues wherever they were. But still, a lot of people would come back to Jerusalem for one or another of the festivals. And at that point, we read in Acts chapter 2 that God chose that scene to be the inaugural scene for his church that he began. And what do we read in Acts chapter 2? In verse 9, the people, the various people who are gathered from all over the world, say, Parthians and Medes and Elamites and residents of Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and the parts of Libya belonging to Cyrene, and visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes, Cretans and Arabs. Okay, these are all the different people from all over the world. And by this point, this is like 500 years after Babylonian captivity, these people speak the languages of the places where they've been living for the last few centuries. And chances are they don't even really understand a lot of the languages that are the common ones in Judah. But these people, as the 12 Galilean uneducated disciples are preaching, these people are saying, we are hearing in our own language the amazing deeds of God. Now, I don't believe that the disciples were speaking those languages. If you count it up, I believe you'll find there are more languages than there are disciples. I believe the miracle was less in the speaking and more in the hearing. But be that as it may, whether speech or hearing, really immaterial to the point that God has created one language. A language of love, a language of humility, a language of the Spirit. It's like it's a reversal of the story of the Tower of Babel, where people were so conceited, so self-consumed, that God had to confuse the languages. Until that time, there had only been one. God had to confuse the languages so that people would spread out and hopefully quit trying to be self-seeking people. Now, God has brought people from all over the world back together and given them one language. Do we speak the same language today? Of course not. Not in a physical sense. But do we speak the same language today in a spiritual sense? Absolutely. We can go anywhere in the world, find brethren who are of like mind, and it doesn't matter whether we can physically communicate with them, we will have that bond because we are all one family. Amen. And we speak that language of love, that language of humility. Back to Zephaniah 3, verse 11. On that day you shall not be put to shame because of the deeds by which you have rebelled against me. For then I will remove from your midst your proudly exultant ones, and you shall no longer be haughty in my holy mountain. But I will leave in your midst a people humble and lowly. They shall seek refuge in the name of the Lord. Those who are left in Israel, they shall do no injustice and speak no lies, nor shall there be found in their mouth a deceitful tongue. For they shall graze and lie down, and none shall make them afraid. Isn't that beautiful? They will no longer be put to shame by their rebellious deeds. Why? Because the arrogant, the proudly exultant ones, have been removed. And the result? Nobody will again be haughty in the presence of God. Because the haughty ones, the proud ones, the insolent ones, the self-seeking ones have been destroyed. Who's left? A people humble and lowly. They shall seek refuge in the name of the Lord. Those who are left in Israel, they shall do no injustice and speak no lies. There shall be found in their mouth no deceitful tongue. For they shall graze and lie down, and none shall make them afraid. When God's people live in humility with each other and with God, God will do amazing things. Beginning with no injustice, no lies, no deceitful tongue. Remember that that common language has been restored, that doesn't have room for a deceitful tongue, doesn't have room for self-seeking. From there, also a picture of plenty and of peace and security. I find the picture a little bit amusing. They shall graze and lie down. It's almost a picture of people on their hands and knees eating grass, but the picture is actually, of course, of livestock, of sheep or whatever, cows that graze and lie down. A picture of plenty, a picture of contentment, of everything going exactly the way it should be. And this was what God longed to do for his people. The result, verses 14 through 20. Sing aloud, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O Israel. Rejoice and exult with all your heart, O daughter of Jerusalem. The Lord has taken away the judgments against you. He has cleared away your enemies. The King of Israel, the Lord, is in your midst. You shall never again fear evil. On that day it shall be said to Jerusalem, fear not, O Zion. Let not your hands grow weak. The ones left by God, the ones dwelling in humility, have cause for rejoicing, celebration. Sing aloud, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O Israel. Rejoice and exult with all your heart. Such a cause for celebration because we're now living with people who are not self-seeking. We are living with people who, like our reading this morning, were looking not only to their own needs, but also to the needs of others, to put others ahead of themselves. And now, verses 17 through 20. The Lord your God is in your midst, a mighty one who will save. He will rejoice over you with gladness. He will quiet you by his love. He will exult over you with loud singing. I will gather those of you who mourn for the festival so that you will no longer suffer reproach. Behold, at that time I will deal with all your oppressors, and I will save the lame and gather the outcast, and I will change their shame into praise and renown in all the earth. At that time I will bring you in, at the time when I gather you together, for I will make you renowned and praised among all the peoples of the earth, when I restore your fortunes before your eyes, says the Lord. Look at verse 17 again. The Lord your God is in your midst, a mighty one who will save. He will rejoice over you with gladness. Remember just a few verses before, Jerusalem was told to rejoice, daughter of Jerusalem, you know, shout for gladness, O Zion. It's a reciprocal thing. As Jerusalem rejoices and exults in God, God is rejoicing over Jerusalem. As Jerusalem sings the praises of her God, what does it say here? He will exult over you with loud singing. What a beautiful picture that God is exulting over us with loud singing. A friend of mine's written a song about that. My God is singing over me. Beautiful, beautiful thought. And what else does he say? Partway through 19, I will save the lame and gather the outcast, and I will change their shame into praise and renown in all the earth. The lame and the outcast, taking away their shame. Does that sound like something that Jesus was doing all the time he was here on earth? He was looking out for the disadvantaged, those who were lame and disabled and whatever. So what does the Lord require of you? Micah answered that in a sermon from a couple of months ago, Micah 6, verse 8. He doesn't want thousands of rams, 10,000 rivers of oil. He doesn't want us to sacrifice our children. What does God require of us? Is to do justice and to love mercy and to walk humbly with our God. Because the kind of problems that plagued Israel and Judah through the entirety of the Old Testament came from their unwillingness to live for God. They were determined to live for themselves. They were self-seeking. They were caught up in this trap of the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eye and the pride of life. Everything was about me. And God has brought us away from that and granted us a new chance at life. That is why when we come to God, we are baptized so that we can participate in the death of Christ by putting to death the way that we have lived until that time. The life of self-seeking. That we can be raised from that water the same way that Jesus was raised from the dead. To live a new life, a life not for self, but for others and for God. There's so much more I want to say, but we are out of time. We talked at our class this morning about the fact that we are called to this life of humility, that we are called to look out for others. We are called to not be self-seeking, but to consider others better than ourselves. And as I said at the very end of Bible class, that considering others better than ourselves isn't just some philosophical thing that we listen to, agree with, and walk away and forget about. It needs to infiltrate every portion of our lives. It needs to change the way that we respond to the people we live with. It needs to change the way we respond to people in the supermarket, to people on the highway. That's, like I said this morning, that's the one that really gets to me. The people at the workplace. Everywhere we go, we see people. Unless we're living like a monk on the top of Mount Everest, then maybe we don't get ticked off by other people. But every time you find yourself losing patience, ask yourself, who do I think I am that my needs are more important than others? Jesus was asked as a trick question, what's the greatest commandment? And he responded with two: love God and love others. When we live a life of humility, when we consider others better than ourselves, when we look not only to our own interests, but also to the interests of others, then and only then is it possible for us to love God and love others. The closing hymn that I've chosen, I think we sang just last time I was here. It's a little bit of a challenging song to sing musically, but we actually made it through. We have a few of our singers missing today, so we'll hope it works. But whether or not it works musically, please let it speak to you. Let the words speak to your soul. Love one another, for love is of God. He who loves is born of God and knows God. He who does not love does not know God, for God is love. Let's stand and sing number 448.